A lot of times you'll see these newspaper articles about straight and cisgender parents who are using they pronouns for their kids. And they seem to have like a different set of motivation. It tends to be like not wanting to like imprint your kid with a whole bunch of gender expectations and all of the pretty little girl, big strong boy kinds of stuff. And they kind of approach it in this way of like, oh yeah, we're not gonna tell people the sex of our child because we don't want your prejudices and biases to influence our kid. And it kind of creates this idea that you know the kid's gender, it's just a secret. But for us, it was like, it's not a secret, we just don't know. It's just a part of our community practice that if you don't know what someone's gender is,
you wait until they can tell you.
Yeah, you wait until they can tell you. And like, you know, a decent option if you don't have any way of asking them is to use they, them pronouns.
Welcome to the Wash Your Mouth Out podcast, Power, Pleasure, and Parenting. We are stigma-smashing feminist parents creating a new narrative. Put in your earbuds. This is for you only. This is the place to be entertained, empowered, inspired, and feel seen while you're raising small humans. We are your hosts, Moriah Malott and Madison Young. Toby Hillmeyer is a multiracial, indigenous, transgender, non-binary woman, nationally renowned political activist, and award-winning writer, children's book author, filmmaker, educator, and speaker. She's the co-executive director of Gender Justice League. Maria caught up with her in Seattle, where she lives, works, and is newly a parent.
Welcome, Toby.
Hey, it's great to be here.
You have a really cool life. One of the recent things in your life is that you became a parent this last October, right? Mm-hmm. So you're newly a parent, and I'm wondering, you know, one of my friends told me that transition to becoming a parent was much more challenging and involved for him than the gender transition. I was like, that's such an interesting way to like sum up how intense early parenting is.
I'll tell you the labor and the time commitments are greater. That's for sure.
What is it like? How is your life different with this new being?
Yeah, you know, it was really interesting for me moving into this because I haven't had a lot of models for being trans, being a trans woman and having a kid after you've transitioned. Like I know a dozen people who, you know, had kids and then when their kids were teenagers, they came out and transitioned, but didn't really know much of anyone who was like pursuing parenthood after being out and transitioning. So it was something that felt important to me and was important to the people in my family. And so we got together and decided that we were gonna make this happen. I'll tell you the big turning point for me was when we had a third parent signed on. Once we were talking about having three parents, that made everything feel so much more doable.
Because you're poly-identified.
Yeah. So a bit about my family. There's three of us who are parents. There's also another partner of mine who is in the household and has explicitly not wanted not to be a parent. And has had that very clear from when we first met in high school. And so the three of us are parenting, and this fourth member of the household is being like incredibly supportive of the family, but has drawn a strict boundary of like not babysitting or doing any of those kinds of things. But I'll tell you that like first couple of weeks after the birth, when we are all exhausted and wiped out, they were doing a ton of caretaking of us. And so like, that's part of how our family kind of all comes together to support each other through all the things that come up around, you know, having a kid and just being a family in general.
Sounds like a much bigger village than most people get at that time, right? You want that village.
I'll tell you, I was very hesitant and tentative to do this without that kind of a support structure.
I mean, it makes me kind of stare off into space and dream a little bit about how things could have been different in the beginning for me, that's for sure. And for so many of my my clients in parent consulting, where oftentimes there's one parent who is working really long hours, and so that's all they can really do. And then there's kind of like one person doing all of the parenting. And you have two children's books out.
Yes.
Superpower Baby Shower and The Princess of Great Daring.
Yeah.
And did you start working on this before becoming a parent?
I did, yeah. In fact, I've just been doing a bunch of writing for quite a while now, but I had a few thoughts in my head of what I might do for a children's book, but it really became a reality for me, actually, when Bear from Flamingo Rampant Press had an author drop out and called me up to be like, hey, do you want to take this author's place? And he puts together these bundles of like six children's books at a time that all kind of like have a focus around LGBTQ families. And between the six books, there's a focus of having a majority of the characters being girls and women, and a majority of the characters being people of color. And so when it was like, oh, so here is my opportunity to just dive in, the only thing is I have to have this finished within a month.
Whoa!
I took a weekend to like think about it, and I realized I really did have some ideas and thoughts about what I wanted to do, and then, you know, quickly put together the first draft.
Made it happen. Oh, that sounds really scary to me as a writer. But you did it. And now we have these great books at Flamingo Rampant Press. Is that where they're?
Yes. So if you want to purchase them right now, I believe the only way to do so is at flamingorampant.com.
Okay.
And you do have to purchase the whole bundle of six books.
Which you want anyway, because I know a lot of people who get this bundle and really enjoy it. So we'll make sure that this link for Flamingo Rampant will be under Toby's interview on our website, along with all kinds of other links for projects.
You can definitely also request this at your library if it's not there already. I know that the Seattle library has several copies.
All right, so your homework is to go to your library and make sure that they have Superpower Baby Shower and A Princess of Great Daring. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Would you read something from one of those for us, please?
Yeah.
So maybe from The Princess of Great Daring.
Okay, so I'm going to jump right into the middle of this. And I'll tell you, part of what really inspired me to write this was I got a chance to see, I think it was a children's book. It was online and just a bunch of images. So I don't know if it was ever published or not, but it was a story about a trans girl princess and a cis girl princess who didn't want to have to do all the girl things. And so they each had their families telling them what they were supposed to do, and they decided to swap places. And their parents were like, well, of course we know it's you, but if you want to do something else, we can make something else happen. Mm-hmm. And it was a really fun, cute story, but it kind of left me with this realization that it has the cis girl princess wants to learn how to sword fight and wants to learn how to be strong and train and become and ultimately the epilogue, like, she becomes a powerful warrior queen who protects her people. And the trans girl princess wants to learn how to sew and be pretty. And in the end, she gets to be a beautiful queen, beloved by her people.
Who still knows how to sew.
And it was just like, you know, noting the differences between being beloved by your people versus protecting your people. I grew up with all of these feminist children's books that were really all about how, like, girls can do anything. And it seemed like there was this subtle message here that cis girls can do anything and trans girls can be pretty. And so I wanted to create my own.
Like, that's the ultimate goal. Like, you shouldn't have any other goals beyond that.
Yeah. So I wanted to create my own story where there could be a trans girl princess who could be everything.
Yes.
And this is the segment of the book that gets right to that. For context, this is a trans girl who has not yet come out to her friends, but plans to this afternoon, and just gets to meet up with them to play a game of princesses and princes. "Jamie, you're just in time," Madison yelled. "We're playing Rescue the Princess." "Yeah," Liam said. "We get to be princes or knights, and we're going to fight a dragon." "I'm going to be a smart and strategic prince who always knows just what to say," said Jackson. "I'm going to be a charming and beautiful prince who everyone wants to be friends with," said Liam. "I'm going to be a brave and strong knight who can beat anyone in a fight," said Madison. They all turned to Jamie. "What kind of prince are you going to be?" Said Jamie. "I'm going to be a princess." "That's perfect," said Madison. "We can all come and rescue you." "No, that's not the kind of princess I'm going to be," said Jamie. "I'm going to be a princess of great daring. I can climb and run and keep up with any of you. I'll wear the most beautiful dresses for parties with Liam. I'll challenge Jackson's wits in chess. And Madison and I will train together to be strong, and the four of us will be the best friends across the land." "But if the princess can take care of herself, then who are we going to rescue?" said Madison. "What if you all rescued me?" said Liam.
Ah, that's what Liam wants. Oh, yeah. So sweet. Oh, now I want to read that whole book. Gotta get it in my library.
Yeah.
Pick up a copy. For those of us with gender variant children, and from your perspective, is there anything in how you were parented? We'll probably talk a little bit more about your upbringing, but anything in how you were parented that you wish were a little different, more supportive? What would have made your life awesome?
Reflecting on my childhood, in many ways, I was raised fairly gender neutral, but it was a second wave lesbian feminist version of gender neutral, which is a little bit different from how we might understand that now. And so, you know, I got a very strong message from my parents that, like, girls can do anything boys can do anything girls can do, don't let gender hold you back. But it was still pretty clear that from their perspective, while I could do any of the things that I wanted to do, they still very much saw me as a boy who was doing those things. And so, I didn't even really conceptualize an alternative until I was, like, towards the end of high school and realized, you know, kind of like, well, what's the difference between, like, being a boy who doesn't do any of the boy things and not being a boy?
Right.
And that, like, ultimately that difference is very personal and something that you have to figure out for yourself. And so I do wish that that had been kind of something that was even just within my family's sense of awareness.
Right, just talked about maybe like more role models, like knowing more people who've chosen different gender paths.
Yeah, and my friends even, my parents even had a friend who was a trans woman who had a kid who was friends with me. But I never knew that she was a trans woman because I think that they understood the way to be an ally is to just never bring it up. And so I just never knew.
Yeah. And things are, and actually back then, like that was very much the way that everything was handled. Wiggle room, and just in terms of how people present and talk about their genders. And that does make it, I guess, a little bit harder for other people to see you and say, that's what I can be when I grow up.
Yeah. You know, right now it is, it's both harder to do that because of all of the like electronic identification systems and the like much better government record keeping. But also, like, it used to be medically mandated that if you're going to transition, you had to basically promise to, like, make up a story about how you grew up and buy pictures from the store or frames from the store and use the pictures in them as baby pictures. And you were, like, required to, like, make up a whole new story about your childhood or else they wouldn't give you access to hormones or surgery.
Yeah. Like transitioning is getting a completely new life and you're a completely different person.
Yeah, kind of like witness protection.
So you would just have, you know, more, you would have more exposure to trans folks in your life as a kid. But in your childhood, I read that you had in your life, so my children have anonymous sperm donors, but you had in your life a known sperm donor.
Yeah.
And can you tell us a little bit about that part of your upbringing?
Yeah, so we lived in the same city for the first like 2 or 3 years of my life, and then have lived in separate cities ever since. So we never had a really close relationship. It was never meant to be a parental relationship, but it was really valuable to like have like an actual a relationship of some sort where we knew each other and could like contact each other in different ways. You know, I think it was something that I definitely really appreciate, knowing that he kind of in many ways felt it was like a feminist duty for him to help my family bring me into the world. There was this it's a bit of a complicated story, but to sum it up, he was a part of some men's feminist groups and he was very disillusioned with the men in those feminist groups, and when my parents asked him for a recommendation or to ask him to ask around if anyone would be a donor, he thought of all of the people who he might pass that around to and would not recommend any of them. And so he felt he had to do it himself. And that's just, it's really cute. And I love that, like, that's part of where I come from. Also, like, my moms are white. And I'm a person of color. It's a really big deal to like be a person of color raised in a family that is exclusively white except for you. And so it was, you know, very, very good that I actually knew a little bit about where I came from in that way too.
Yeah, did he talk with you about his background when you were young?
Yeah, it definitely came up in a couple of different ways. And I remember like a couple moments where he would like share with me some of the kind of like myths and spirituality. And but a lot of it too is just like knowing a bit more about that extended family I have on his side. Except for the most part, that extended family doesn't know I exist.
So that wasn't that, so you don't really have access to the extended family.
You know, he has a couple of kids who are my half siblings, and I've gotten to meet and hang out with them. I think there's even like a cousin I got introduced to at one point. But especially at the time, you know, he came from a fairly conservative family, and giving away his firstborn to lesbians was something he didn't quite want to tell everyone about right off the bat. And then
I know how to bring that up.
And then the older I got, the harder it got
it
to bring that up.
Yes. Yes. So. As things go that way. And what is his background? You said indigenous, so Native American.
He's Chicano, and my grandfather is from the Yaqui tribe.
And all this family stuff, there's also the third parent adoption stuff that you're working on. Tell me about that.
So I'll say, actually, so growing up, second parent adoption was not an option when I was born. So literally, like, my birth mom was a legal parent, and in order for my other mom to gain parental rights, my birth mom would have to give up parental rights
at that time.
And so it was definitely something that I was aware of, and especially dealing with some of the anti-family, like, hate groups out there, it became a scary thing for me. Like, I remember being 9, and there was a big statewide vote on whether or not gays and lesbians could be parents, and you know, like, the actual law was about whether or not adoption is possible, but people just always said it's whether or not they can be parents. And so, like, I literally thought that if people voted the wrong way, like, the police would come and take me away from my parents. And so, like, having that kind of stuff going on when you're like 9 years old, It was significant. And so when I was 16, it actually became legal to do second parent adoption. And, you know, I was almost 18, but my family still did that. And then when I got to the point of starting to think about having my own kid, I realized that I might be creating the same situation over again if my kid might have three parents, and one of whom could not be legally recognized, then our family would have to deal with the exact same thing that I dealt with growing up. And so I did a bunch of...
Your child might have to, like, kind of mentally feel like they are choosing, like, oh, which two are my real parents? You know, that's so sad.
And so I did some research, and I really wanted to make sure that there were some kind of options. I even got to lobby for a bill a year and a half ago that helped make third parent adoption easier, although it was already technically possible. And now we're going through that whole process, which is a lot more complicated than I initially thought. Like, our kid is almost 10 months old now, and we're just going to finalize this in the next couple of months, maybe, hopefully. And it's also going to cost like $3,000 or $4,000. So there's some things about it that have been a little difficult. Oh, and I'll tell you,
why should it be $3,000 or $4,000? That's just so much money.
It's because there's not like a form you can fill out and turn into the government. You have to, like, hire a lawyer, and then you have to, like, pay a social worker to come and do a home visit, and you need to get, like, a psych eval and a whole bunch of things like that. And And I'll tell you, one of the things that was a little bit difficult is there, like going through this process, there's all of these questions and like a detailed financial background and detailed mental health background, like this whole thing about like, have you ever seen a therapist? And if so, what
for
was it
what?
For? And having to say all these things and just being like, oh my God, is there some chance that like, if one of us has dealt with depression, that like, you're gonna not allow us to be a legally recognized parent of a kid who we are parenting? And so it's a little like,
and that won't be true.
Yeah.
That's not how they do things.
No.
But it's so scary.
Yeah.
To see that.
It feels like that sometimes. And it's also kind of like, well, why are you asking this question? Like, why do you need to ask this question? And I think like part of it is like, you know, okay, now you have to go through these steps to prove that you're an adequate parent, which, you know, it is sometimes you can think of it like it's not so bad because it is important to be an adequate parent.
Mm-hmm.
And if there's anywhere where we're not there, then we'd like to shore things up. But it's also like, not everyone has to go through this.
And also, you know, there's being an adequate parent, and then there's also the fact that what does adequate mean? Because many, many, many people get to be parents and aren't adequate parents, or, you know, just don't have everything exactly together and
yeah.
still get to be parents and still love their children. And with mental illness, you know, still get to be parents. So what if someone wrote, you know, oh, I have bipolar disorder? Or
mm-hmm.
what happens then? Or wrote, I have, you know,
yeah.
any number of things. And I wonder what, I don't know what happens at that point.
I mean, it's very case by case basis,
yeah.
but actually right here in Seattle, there's an increase of cases where child protective services are taking folks' kids away because of mental illness.
Oh no.
So like, yeah, my partner is a nurse and has some work that intersects with that and is able to see some of that happening right now, which is just really disappointing. And I think about, you know, everything gets so much more personal when being a parent now, I can look at those tragedies and they've always been tragedies, but it does feel different now when I'm like, wow, that could happen to my kid.
Yeah.
And how would I feel if that happened to my kid?
Heavy. So one of the things that some adoptive parents and quote unquote alternative relationships of various types might decide to do is inducing lactation
mm-hmm.
on a body that did not go through pregnancy. Mm-hmm. And you had said that that's something that you did.
Yeah.
Yeah, tell us about it. What's
yeah.
like?
So, you know, I've been looking at all of the details of that for years. And actually like one of my co-parents, has gone through like a lactation education course and started like putting together some information for trans people who are looking to induce lactation. And so I felt pretty equipped to do something around that. And then like literally just like a month or two before I was ready to get going, a case study was published in a medical journal about a trans woman inducing lactation. And
mm-hmm.
so it was really nifty to be like,
wow.
here is a new model for how this might work that is more specifically for me. And so I got to go through that process, which in some ways is a little bit even easier being a trans woman because I'm already taking estrogen. And that like it's more of a situation where I just need to increase my doses for a while. And when you have more estrogen and progesterone in your body, it kind of tricks your body into thinking you're pregnant. That's how the pill works. And then, you know, after a few months of that, while also taking domperidone, which encourages milk production, and pumping regularly. Pumping a lot was a really important ingredient in the equation. And then you kind of like drop your levels back down and your body thinks that you just gave birth, and that's how you kind of get things started.
How long before the baby's birth did you start with the pumping?
3 months. Mm-hmm. So that's an interesting thing too. So for, I had health insurance that covered a breast pump, but it only covered a breast pump after the birth. And so I called them up and they're like, okay, yeah, we'll totally cover this. Just tell us when your baby's born and then we'll give it to you. Mm-hmm. And I was like, no, I need to be pumping now and for like months before the birth if I want to be able to feed my kid when they're mm-hmm. born. And so like I ended up getting a hand-me-down pump, which actually kind of like caused some problems for my nipples. And like finally it was actually at the birth where we got to see a lactation consultant.
Oh, okay. And did you not have a proper size flanges or something?
Yeah, no. Mm-hmm. And so that was a lot of work. And I think like the recommendation was 3 to 6 times a day. And while working full time, like I was lucky to get 3 times a day, which was enough, but it's just, yeah, for those couple of months, you might, like, after a month of pumping, I would see, like, a little droplet here and there.
Yeah. You go, oh, it's working, and, but really slowly.
Yeah, it was a little nerve-wracking to be, like, right up to the birth, being like, yes, if I pump all day, I can produce, like, a quarter teaspoon.
I remember when the article about that, mm-hmm. that study came out. And I posted it on my work page, Savvy Parenting Support, and a whole bunch of parents commented, how is this possible? This can't possibly be possible. And, you know, fortunately nothing too terrible, but just kind of confused, how is this possible? And all I had to do was write to them, you know, you've probably had people who were assigned female at birth in your life who have had insufficient glands and who have had some other, maybe PCOS or some other reasons for not being able to produce enough milk or getting it started, and will have to have crazy pumping schedule, will have to take domperidone or metoclopramide, and have to go through a really similar thing. And mm-hmm. so it's like, you know, we have bodies, we have mammary glands, and people who are assigned male at birth have mammary glands, and sometimes it takes a little bit more to get things going. So, yeah, you know, it's totally possible.
And you know, it's just like I've been on hormones like well over a decade. Like I've got breasts, and breasts do what breasts do.
Yep.
I do also want to say, though, an exciting follow-up piece to that is through my work, we do some advocacy with the legislature, and we got to work on the Reproductive Healthcare Access for All bill. And because I was involved in that, I got to insert into the bill something that says that insurance companies have to cover breast pumps for expecting parents. And so going forward, if someone's in the same position I was, they won't have to use a hand-me-down pump.
Well, that is not only important for folks who were in the same position as you, but I don't know if you know this, but you will be doing a huge service to everybody, because now, sorry, you can't see, but I'm totally tearing up because I love this work. Because now everybody is being told when you're about to have a baby to, especially in case you might be, if you think you might have any trouble with lactation right away after the baby is born, let's say it happened to you the first time, you think it might happen a second time, or you might be knowing that you're going to have a super medicated birth or a cesarean, it's recommended to pump some breast milk ahead of time, just a tiny bit of colostrum if you can. So that can be good for lots and lots of people. And now that's the law?
That is now the law in the state
Thank
of
you,
Washington.
Toby. We're not kidding when we say, you know, an activist, getting things done.
One more thing that I'll say about inducing lactation is the end result of that is that we have three parents and all three of us attempted to lactate. And we ended up with like 2.5. But like when you have multiple breastfeeding parents, that opens up all kinds of opportunities. Like you don't have to be the only person who's waking up for midnight feedings. We can like switch things off in different ways. And it's just like been super convenient and helpful in addition to just being like, feeling like a really good experience to share. And it's made a lot of the different logistics of our family just work that much more smoothly.
I mean, there has been a huge general feminist critique of breastfeeding as an institution, in that for many families, it sort of can lead to somebody feeling like they don't get to have themselves, like they don't get to have their body when they want to have it because somebody else, quote, owns it, and that there isn't enough help for feeding the baby, and that they're the only person who really has to, you know, get up and do all of the night feedings. And that's, you know, as a feminist and a lactation professional, that's something that I'm always thinking about, is that, yeah, there is an intense burden when there's one breastfeeding parent. And so, you know, what I try and do is set people up with a plan where, at least where they'll be pumping, that bottle feeding gets introduced really quickly. Whereas sometimes people are encouraged not to do that, because just to set up breastfeeding, but we kind of find the sweet spot in terms of when to make sure that breastfeeding is set up and then still be able to introduce the bottle before the baby becomes bottle pumping. And so that, you know, so that we can have lives, so that we can take a break, so that someone else can feed the baby at night. You know, these are ways that we can survive early parenting with our sanity intact.
Speaking of which, we did ads for our own offerings as a sponsor break this week, and Madison recorded mine. Here it is.
Struggling in life with a tiny person? Maria has a present for you in her birthday month. Through October 31st, 2019, Maria is offering $100 off gentle sleep, gentle discipline, and potty learning private consulting support packages with the code October in all caps. Online DIY classes in sleep, gentle discipline, and potty are also at a new low price. Like a true Libra, Maria's parenting support balances the behavioral and biological science, attachment and nutrition, with building excellent communication skills and your confidence in setting boundaries. Her goal is to get the needs of both child and parent beautifully met by giving you an education on all of your choices and what to expect around your parenting challenge, where your unique goals and unique child are prioritized rather than one-size-fits-all advice. Again, you can get $100 off Maria's already affordable consulting packages, including her most popular Get Your Brain Back sleep support package with the code OCTOBER in all caps by October 31st at SavvyParentingSupport.com.
Shit, sleep has never sounded so sexy. Thanks, Madison. Back to our show.
I'm wondering about for your own child, as a trans-identified person, and also non-binary identified person. Mm-hmm. How have you been, and how do you plan to handle talking about your child's gender with your child and with other people?
Yeah, so it's interesting to me, some of the conversations going on around using they pronouns for babies. And that's definitely something that we wanted to do and just like hold off on assigning a gender and wait until they are old enough to tell us. But I've run into kind of this distinction where a lot of times you'll see these newspaper articles about mostly straight and cisgender parents who are using they pronouns for mm-hmm. their kids, and they seem to have like a different set of motivations. It tends to be like not wanting to like imprint your kid with a whole bunch of gender expectations and all of the like, you know, pretty little girl, big strong boy kinds of stuff. And they kind of approach it in this way of like, oh yeah, we're not gonna tell people the sex of our child because we don't want your prejudices and biases to influence our kid. And it kind of creates this idea that like, you know, the kid's gender, it's just a secret.
Right.
But for us, it was like, it's not a secret. We just don't know. It's just a part of our community practice that if you don't know what someone's gender is,
you wait until they can tell you.
Yeah, you wait until they can tell you. And like, you know, a decent option if you don't have any way of asking them is to use they, them pronouns.
Yes, that's an interesting perspective about where the motivation is coming from. So folks, check your motivations for sure. And you know, that sort of gets expanded in my mind when I'm thinking about the many, you know, gender variant children in my life. You know, sometimes they're not old enough to really understand what all of their gender options are, especially if maybe they have like one or two people in their life that are saying you have all the options in the rainbow, and the rest of society and all the rest of their family is really binary focused and mm-hmm. very sure about what they are. And so I think that even when someone might otherwise choose they, them pronouns, it can be hard when they're really young for them to know that they can or what they should be doing, or that worrying about what everybody's going to think. And so one of the things that I just try and stress again is like, just because someone goes by he or she doesn't mean that has anything to do with anything else, right? The pronoun doesn't have to do with necessarily with how they dress or how they act mm-hmm. or what they like. Or their anything about their personality. So, you know, pronouns are don't have to be they're just words. They don't have to be tied to everything.
Yeah.
Yeah. You also you've been in some erotica?
Yes.
And you've written some erotica. It's like your body has been in some erotica.
That's true.
Yes.
Yeah. So I actually for a while, I love to put this in my bio, especially when I'm being introduced for a performance, that like I'm one of the few people in the world who is both a children's book author and an award-winning porn maker. It's kind of like me and Dr. Seuss, only Dr. Seuss used a different name.
So Madison, so you know, our co-host here, Madison Young, who's not with us right at this moment, I'm sure that she will have children's books out at some point and will join you
yes.
as the award-winning porn actor plus a children's book author.
That would be lovely.
You know, and hopefully this podcast is just opening up those realms so that people know that mm-hmm. you don't have to just be a sexual being or a parent.
Yeah.
Which is kind of what society wants to tell us once we're parents is, oh, the sexy part stops now, right?
Mm-hmm.
You have edited and have a piece in Nerve Endings, the new trans erotica.
Mm-hmm.
When did that come out?
Yeah, that came out about 2 years ago.
Yeah. Was it the first book of its kind?
You know, I tried to do something that was very new and different. It was not the first book of erotica written by trans people. There's like, I don't know, three or four before it. But it definitely was doing something that was a little bit different from what I had previously seen. And the big focus I had, and that I've had for all of my erotic work, has been to really kind of depict a holistic perspective of sexuality, which is kind of like including the hard stuff. A lot of times if people are looking at erotica or especially porn, like it kind of gets boiled down into being this perfect fantasy, but our own lives often look very different. And so I wanted to include like everything about what's going on for people in our community around sex. And that might include abuse, that might include trauma, that might include like societal judgments, or a whole bunch of things like that. It also includes like a whole range of relationships and caretaking. And so kind of like making space for all of these things to be present in the stories in this book. I think one of the few negative reviews that I've had from online reviewers was that they couldn't masturbate to every story because
they're too real.
Yeah, because some of the stories are dealing with like healing from trauma, and I love this idea of having like you know, escapism, which isn't about a world where there are no problems, but escaping to a world where we can envision how we can overcome our problems. So like there's a story in there about a trans woman raising her nephew in a zombie apocalypse. There's a story about orcs dealing with childhood sexual assault triggers.
Okay, what's orcs?
Or like elves and orcs.
Okay.
Dwarves and goblins.
Okay. Yeah. I don't know enough about that.
And there's like a story in there about dealing with sex worker burnout, and a story about dealing with an anxiety disorder, and like the different ways that our relationships and our partners are there for us, and we support each other, or the ways that they're not.
I want this book now. Where am I going to get this book?
Well, this one is available pretty much anywhere where books are sold. It's
where would you like people to find them?
The best place to buy the book is to go straight to the publisher, and that is instarbooks.com.
Okay, we'll post that link.
And, you know, you also can go to local small bookstores.
Your bookstores, make sure they have it. Ask them to get it for you.
It's distributed through the Small Book Distribution Network.
Did you want to read some from Nerve Endings?
Yeah, I've got a section here.
Make sure your earbuds are in, parents. Might not be for the children. I mean, unless you're the kind of parent that I am. You're like, oh, well, you'll hear whatever.
So this is a selection from the story I wrote for the anthology, and so it does this thing where it, like, one by one introduces half a dozen characters, and I'm skipping all their introductions, so you're not going to know who anybody is, and that's fine.
Okay.
But I will tell you that the basic premise of the story is it's about a young trans woman who is attending her very first sex party and is pretty nervous about it.
Is this like a kinky sex party or just like an orgy?
Yeah, so it's actually, the story's called Brunch Service. And the whole thing is focused around it's organized by a couple, and it's that one of them wants to be the service submissive who is serving a group of trans women brunch. And they put together this party, and they invited all of their friends from the trans lady picnics that they organized together the past couple years, and then this happens.
All right.
So I'm jumping right into the hot part. "Ma'am, I don't want to presume your preferences for kinds of sex," Angela said. "But if you so desired, I'd be honored for you to fuck me however you like. There's condoms, gloves, dams, and lube tucked under the table next to you." Rachel and Catherine had their arms around each other and were kissing. Monica moaned loudly from the attention she was getting. Evelyn leaned back and was enjoying the show. Addison was caressing Angela's back and quietly speaking, "That's right. That's a good girl. I'm so happy with you. You're doing so well right now." "When I see Catherine fucking Angela that way, I mean, using her junk to penetrate her, I'm struck with amazement and perhaps a bit of confusion. All these messages are running through my head. She's fucking like a man, taking the male role. She looks like some kind of chick with a..." I close my eyes and try to shut them out. Then I look again. She doesn't actually look like anything but herself. Despite the internalized messaging still playing on a loop in my head, I can't actually imagine her as a guy, even if I try. And sure, I've seen that motion in movies and in porn, but come to think of it, I've seen images of women thrusting their hips in the same way just as much, sometimes with strap-ons, sometimes just tri-humping. I wonder, how does that work for her? Does she feel dysphoria about it? I mean, how could she not? Does she just do it anyway? Does she hide from it or dissociate from that part? It kind of makes me wonder if I could ever... No, I don't think I could. When I think of what she's doing, I alternate between a half dozen feelings. There's disgust at the thought of it. There's admiration. I'm impressed that she's capable of it. It makes me see her as strong in a way I hadn't considered. There's a sense of amazement at how much pleasure they both seem to be having. And there's a feeling of shame at the thought of enjoying something like that. There's shame at the idea that I've been caught in the same room as it. And maybe, just maybe, there might be a bit of jealousy. There was a hand on my shoulder. It was Laura. "So, I wasn't sure if I was going to come to this or not, but then I heard you would be here." She smiled and cast her eyes down, stealing glances up at me. "Is that flirting? But I was wondering if you might be up for..." Laura was blushing now. "Can I kiss you?" She was so cute how embarrassed she was getting. Suddenly, all the times she hung out after meetings were done, or the note of excitement in her voice when she said hi to me, made a lot more sense. How could I not have noticed? I leaned in and gave her a kiss, and then I pulled away to see her face. A wide grin was plastered over it. She laughed slightly, and then she leaned over and kissed me again, more deeply, and she pushed me back onto the arm of the couch. Coming to this party was definitely a good idea.
Awesome, thank you.
Yeah.
There's so much in there that I can relate to in terms of like the first few times that I ever saw porn with trans women, right? Like just as like a cis lesbian, just like, whoa, the mind is kind of blown and what all, I'm thinking so many things, right?
Yeah.
It's really awesome to capture that complexity. Because usually erotica is not so complex about what's really going on, right?
Yeah, and I really wanted to explore this because it is such a meaningful and significant issue for a lot of trans women in every which direction. Like there are people who feel like expectations that they have to have penetrative sex that way. And they feel ashamed if they don't. And there's other people who feel like they're not allowed to, and they feel ashamed if they want to.
Yes.
And I know that like I myself have like gone through both sides of that half a dozen times. So, and I hadn't really seen many places where it actually is discussed. And so I felt like this would be a perfect place to discuss
yes.
it.
Thank you for that. I think that that's enriching for our listeners to hear.
I will also say that in addition to nerve endings, Best Lesbian Erotica has asked to include the story in their upcoming anthology.
That story. Oh.
And
we are moving forward, people.
And they also asked me to extend it and make it more sexy. So it is now a longer version that should be coming out later this year. And if we ever get around to doing like a second edition of Nerve Endings, then the longer edition would be in there too.
Best Lesbian Erotica has yeah. been around for a long time. I don't know how long, but I know that as a young person, that was some of my first access to lesbian erotica.
Yeah.
That is so cool. And I also have heard that you performed a one-woman show.
Yeah, that's
Tell
right.
Tell me about that.
So I'll say when it comes to art, I find myself jumping from medium to medium to medium. Mostly because I think that the process of learning a new medium and challenging myself in that really is important to me. And it feels good to be able to do that. And so I've done a bunch of different performances, like storytelling, stand-up comedy even. But I wanted to like do something in that vein that was much bigger. And I put together Fallen Star, a one-woman play about a trans superhero turned villain who tries to take over the world. And I did this actually through the Gay City Arts Program here in Seattle. And it turned out to be a really great opportunity to kind of like create this container to create this play. It's a story that I had been working on for a couple of years before then, but then it took me like another year to turn it into a play and get it ready for performance. And the basic idea of it is that there's a pair of trans women who are the first two trans women to join the Heroes Regional Council, and they are trying to like break that glass ceiling and kind of like change the system from within and like be a presence so that the other heroes know about trans people, but they still experience like a lot of discrimination and ableism when they're in this Heroes Council. And ultimately one of them disappears. This isn't a spoiler, it's like right from it's the first paragraph mm-hmm. of the play. But she disappears under suspicious circumstances, and it encourages the character I play to leave the Heroes Regional Council because they're just not really caring. They're not really like trying to put a stop to what happened because it's outside of the legal system. And she realizes that like there's a difference between law and justice, and that she is tired of being around all the super cops and wants to go find her own justice, and ultimately comes up with this plan to take over the world. And at the very end of the play, we turn off the house lights and ask everyone in the audience to try to convince me one way or the other whether like taking over the world is worth the death count. Or if it is more important to take a slower but in some ways more peaceful path to liberation.
And so does it go different ways based on the audience you have?
yeah, so the way I actually set it up is that one of the audience members is selected to be the decision maker, and the rest of the audience has to try and convince them one way or the other. And I have multiple endings set up for depending on which way they choose.
And this is also a book.
I made a comic book that goes with it.
Oh, comic book. Oh,
so
cool.
There's a comic book that goes with it, but does not tell the whole story.
Okay.
The comic book kind of like is used to tell some of the pieces of the story that I couldn't do in a one woman play format.
Yeah.
And then I actually like will play an animated video using the comic book images in between the scenes of the play.
Oh, great.
So the comic book is like a teaser that you can get to see what it looks like. And then I'm definitely pitching it to like colleges and universities to book me to come and perform this play.
Great. And any other creative projects we haven't talked about yet?
I will mention, too, about Nerve Endings. I'm looking to do an additional volume of Nerve Endings. And I'm actually hoping to have the call for submissions for that out sometime soon. So maybe if that gets put together before this podcast is released, we'll include that in the show notes.
How will people know that you've put out the call for submissions?
You can also go to my website, tobyhillmeyer.com, and you can find it there. I'll be sending it around to several different listings and places like that too, including like, I think probably the biggest one of them is like it's the Erotic Readers and Writers Association.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you'll see it if you're regularly writing erotica and if you follow Toby. So you are the co-executive director of Gender Justice League.
Yeah.
Which is an incredible organization that I keep hearing about in a zillion ways. What is currently going on? What are the current projects of Gender Justice League?
Well, the big one we just wrapped up for the year is Trans Pride. We put together Trans Pride Seattle every year, and it is we'd like to call it a small intimate gathering in the park with our closest 15,000 friends.
Yeah.
And it really like holds on to a lot of the spirit of pride that a lot of people are missing from other pride celebrations.
I heard it was really awesome this year.
We always have a march, not a parade. And we invite people to perform and speak from our stage who are going to speak to a variety of different important, meaningful issues. And then we have a whole bunch of organizations that we invite to table. And this year we expanded our space so that we could have close to 100 organizations tabling. And that was pretty amazing.
Awesome. Any other projects with the Gender Justice League
yeah.
that you're proud of from the
yeah.
past or coming
so,
out?
I think one of the biggest things that I'm most proud of is that we we are primarily an advocacy organization, and we have done a lot of work around trans healthcare. There used to be, and around the country still are, trans exclusion clauses in health insurance that basically say, if you're trans, we won't cover anything related to transition, which has been used in some pretty horrendous ways. There's actually an example from right here in Washington where there was a trans woman who was playing in a lesbian softball league and she broke her arm, and the insurance company said, oh, if you hadn't transitioned, you wouldn't have been playing in that league. Therefore, we won't cover your broken arm.
What kind of mess is that?
Exactly. So,
that makes no sense at all.
I know. It's the most blatant example out there. But even like I myself once was denied an allergy test because I went in to get an allergy test with a new doctor, and the doctor asked me what medications I was taking and wanted to know more about those medications I was taking because she was not familiar with how hormones work for trans people. And she took detailed notes about it, and then the insurance company was like, oh, it looks like the purpose of your visit was hormones, so we're not going to cover that visit. So it's pretty blatant discrimination,
yes.
But because insurance companies are often under a different jurisdiction than other businesses, they've been able to get away with it for quite a while. And we push really hard to remove those exclusion clauses in Washington here. And we have, we started by getting the Public Employees Benefits Board to remove it from all state employee plans, and then also got the state Medicaid program to remove those exclusions, and then finally got the insurance commissioner to put out a bulletin saying the state non-discrimination policy applies here, and that is not going to be allowed in any of the private plans either. And so there's only a couple of loopholes. At this point, the only way those policies are going to exist in Washington is if it is with a major company that is self-insuring, or if it is with a major company based in another state. Then those are the only ways that it can kind of get around the laws that we've put in place to make sure that doesn't happen anymore.
Mm.
And then a really big thing that we started doing about a year and a half ago is we got our own office. After like several years, we finally had our own office, and we moved into an office that was coded both commercial and residential, just kind of as a fluke. It turned out to be the one that was most affordable and easiest to get. And then we had people in the community who were losing their housing, and we thought, hey, we've got a full bath and shower, a kitchenette, a loft, laundry services down the hall. Like, we should make use of this. And
yeah,
we started letting people stay in our office for emergency housing. And that actually got expanded to
lifesaver.
Yeah, to this year, actually, beginning in January, we got a contract with the city to provide services for survivors of gender-based violence, which is helping us build out that program. And so we're doing more and more when it comes to direct services now. And one of the really interesting things that comes with that is because we're getting this city contract to address gender-based violence, the city includes that to mean domestic violence, sexual assault, and commercial sexual exploitation. And so now we are helping survivors of trafficking, and have been plugged into the city coalitions of other organizations that are working on trafficking. And now, like just in the past couple of months, I've been kind of pushing a lot of these organizations to have conversations about some of the policy advocacy that we could do. And we're really trying to kind of like build out a coalition that includes anti-trafficking organizations, sex worker advocacy organizations, and a whole bunch of different people to work on some of the common sense law reforms that will make things better for everyone.
Yeah, that keeps coming up in this conversation is, when you make things better for a group of oppressed people, it makes things better for everybody.
Yeah.
It does. It just goes everywhere. Yep. For folks in states that don't have Gender Justice League, who are listening to this and realizing, oh yeah, I might not know a lot of trans folks, but trans folks have families and I want to help protect everybody. What is, if you don't have Gender Justice League in your state as an ally, from a working toward like healthcare policy and policy, you know, is there anything that you've come across that seems like a good entry for an ally to try and jump into some work?
Well, I will say that allies are incredibly needed. Volunteering can make a really big difference. And it's also really important that we have trans-led organizations. For the longest time, we had LGBTQ organizations whose leadership did not include trans people, and those were the organizations doing the work on trans issues. So it makes a really big difference to have organizations led by trans people doing this work. And one of the best things that people can do is to donate to those organizations.
So find your local trans-led organizations. And I wonder if there's some way to create an environment where those organizations can exist, can pop up, and can thrive.
Well, we've done some work actually supporting other organizations that are starting up. And I'll also point to the National Center for Transgender Equality and the Transgender Law Center as other organizations that are doing work across the United States that we're all in positions to kind of like support.
Those are all places we can financially donate to.
Yeah. You don't have to live you don't have to live next to them to donate to them. And then you'll get on the mailing list and you'll find out about things that are going on. And then when you're finding out that there's something going on that just happens to intersect with the work that you do,
yeah,
or the friend you have that's on one of these boards, then you'll like be ready to jump in and help make those connections that actually make change happen.
Yeah. Okay, I don't know if I'm going to remember this or if I wrote it down, but there was something that you guys did. My friend, maybe you'll remember the organization, but my friend was telling me that, and you may have shown up for this, where there's an organization, a tech organization. It's like about folks in tech supporting trans folks, and that there was a group from Gender Justice League that went to this gathering of tech folks where there was like a talk about trans rights, and a group of folks, I guess from Gender Justice League came in and said, like, these are the things we need to get done. This is actually the line items of like things we need to get like paid for various things, and like who will like step up and say like, I'll help you get that done. Who will go to the courthouse and go to the courthouse and say, I'm gonna be quoted as saying that I believe in blah blah blah.
Yeah, I can't remember the specifics around that, but I know that we do stuff like that all the time, and that we get invited to groups to kind of like let people know what's going on. That sounds kind of like it was at a time when we were putting on our ID clinics. It was right after Trump got elected, and a lot of people were really concerned that particularly the rules around passports would be harder for trans people to get passports, and everyone wanted to try and update their name and gender while they still could.
Mm-hmm.
And we put together like three clinics over 3 months where we served 400 people. There were doctors who volunteered to come and meet with people and sign letters. There were lawyers who came to like talk through the forms and the process, and a photographer who took folks' photos for passports. And it worked really wonderfully. And there's still work going on to kind of like support that kind of stuff.
That's important. It sounds like it kind of just like all came together, and it's like work that can get done so quickly. Like, just get these people their passports.
Yeah.
And it's so great to see that the Gender Justice League has been able to take on these projects and then really kind of come to a place of like, not completion, like it's ending, but really be able to look back at the work and say,
yeah,
we did that. Yeah. At the end of our time with our podcast guests, we like to ask everybody to get back to parenting.
Mm-hmm.
What is your current parenting challenge first? Like, what is like the one challenge that's on your mind? And then what is the one big joy?
I'd say that the biggest challenge right now is that our kid has made a very, very solid connection between falling asleep and nursing. And absolutely
that's my whole work.
cannot go to sleep unless nursing. And so we're like trying to like switch to rocking.
Doesn't
like
matter
nurse
whose
for
boobies, right?
Bit. Yeah,
but anybody's
still
boobies,
run
but
into that.
Boobies.
Yeah, and so like that's something that we're working on. And I say my real joy right now, and I was just telling people about this earlier today, is when I grew up, connection to animals was like really important to me from the time I was very little. I had a dog, I carried my cat around when I was 2, and then when I was like 5, I made friends with all of the birds in the campground and all those kinds of things. And so I really wanted to be able to share that connection with my kid. And so like from the very beginning, I've been introducing them to our family cat and helping them like see and understand what a cat is and how they are similar and different to us and what cats need and what cats like. And they are just like, they've never grabbed our cat, which I think is pretty amazing. They are pretty good at petting gently. Sometimes they'll like wave their hand a little bit too strong, but just this morning, they're in this phase where they're vocalizing a whole lot, and it's really hard to tell if they're actually saying words or mm-hmm. if it just randomly happens to line up. But this morning they like pulled themselves up on the chair the cat was sleeping in and reached out their hand and said meow meow meow.
Oh, I mean, that's 3 in a row. That's probably talking.
A lot of the noises they make are 3 in a row.
Okay.
Like,
but
whatever,
it's all the
yeah.
same, right? It's like,
yeah.
meow, 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 and there's the cat. So
yeah,
it seems
exactly.
pretty,
I think
seems
so.
Pretty clear. Meow, meow, meow. Those are not sounds that are typical babble sounds.
Yeah.
So I think you've got some language happening.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Toby. We're going to make sure that people can find you mm-hmm. at Toby with an I, T-O-B-I, Hill, H-I-L-L, Meyer, M-E-Y-E-R.com. And Toby's work over at genderjusticeleague.org. Mm-hmm. And social, any social media you want to throw out?
I'm hardly on social media anymore. Like, you can find me on Facebook, but I don't really post there.
Okay. So we won't do social media. Any other place that we should find you?
Nope. I think, you know, you can follow my work at genderjusticeleap.org. And as there are non-work projects I'm working on, they'll be coming out at tobyhillmeyer.com.
Great. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Wash Your Mouth Out Podcast. You can find us on the web at washyourmouthoutpodcast.com. Come follow us on Instagram at Wash Your Mouth Out Podcast and on Twitter at Mouth Out Podcast. You've been dreaming of writing a book for years. You open your computer and stare at a blank page and just can't push past that void in front of you. You know that writing this book will further your business, solidify your position as an expert in your field, lead to speaking opportunities, and fuel your creative self. Yet despite it all, you are struggling to manifest this work on your own. You are not alone. This is why three-time author Madison Young created Written in the Stars, an online coaching program to guide you step by step through writing your book in just 12 weeks. This 12-week guide to manifesting your book includes lifetime access to over 30 videos, audio guides, handouts, and weekly group video meetups with Madison and all of the other writers, including me. I'll see you there. You can check out this inspiring online course at writteninthestars.eventbrite.com. Madison is offering this course at a 10% discount to our listeners with the code SOAP, S-O-A-P, all caps. Again, that is writteninthestars.eventbrite.com.